And now it is my pleasure to welcome you to the healthcare and life management session on immunological testing. This afternoon's session will be presented by Dr. Francisco Bonilla. Dr. Bonilla is the program director of the Clinical Immunology Program at Children's Hospital Boston and an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School in Massachusetts. And he is a member of the IDF Medical Advisory Committee. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Bonilla.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tara. So we're going to have what may seem like a whirlwind tour of biotechnology as it applies to immunological testing, because my intent is to give you some kind of sense of how we look at your immune system function and what we think about when we're looking at it. There may be some basic scientific principles of one thing or another that perhaps you didn't see in your past education. I'm going to try to make this as basic as I can, but still give you some idea of the concepts that are applied when we test immune function. So we are going to move around a little bit from one area to another, because we're going to talk about a lot of different aspects of immune function. And if you have a question, just throw up your hand, because I'd like everybody to make the journey together. So those are my disclosures, which really don't matter for our discussion today. So first, just one very important principle that seems to get people hung up a lot, and that's how important age is, especially early age. So obviously we do lots of immune evaluation on infants and children when they're growing up. And a lot of things about how the immune system works when you're little are different from how the immune system works when you're older. And a lot of times, even physicians don't remember often that this is a problem, or they may assume that a laboratory knows that this is an issue when in fact they don't. So I get regular referrals for kids with immune problems whose doctors think they're sick because they had a lab test done somewhere where they didn't use a normal range for a particular test that was appropriate for a child. So, you know, a two-year-old has an IgG of 500, and somebody says, oh, they have hypogammaglobulinemia. Well, no, actually, 500 is great for a two-year-old. Might not be great for a 25-year-old. But so this is one thing that's very important to understand. We're not going to come back to this idea very much in our talk, but I think it's important for everyone here as patients and parents to remember that and know that it can be an issue sometimes. So we're just going to jump into the nitty-gritty of how we do these tests. So the first test that almost everybody has when they're sick or healthy and you want to know something about the big picture for the immune system is called the cellular blood count and differential, or a CBC with a diff if you're a doctor. Human beings don't really do this test as such anymore. This is all automated and done by machines, and pretty much the only thing the technician does is shake up a tube and stick it on the machine. And the machine decides based on the properties of the size and the color and other characteristics of the different cells that are being put in there, what's a red blood cell, what's a white blood cell, what type of white blood cell it is, and so on. So, you know, when we think about red blood cells, we think about the hemoglobin content, which is the oxygen-carrying protein, and how much of the blood volume that represents, the blood volume that's represented by the red blood cells themselves, the hematocrit, the total number of cells, and then different things about them, like how big they are, their volume, how much hemoglobin each cell has, the different sizes of cells in the circulation, and whether or not they have an abnormal shape or whether they're fragments and things like that. And even though, you know, red blood cells are not per se critical components of the immune system in many respects, a lot of people with immune problems do develop problems with their red blood cells. So you absolutely have to know that you're not anemic or having some other issue that could definitely impact your health. Of course, we also look at platelets, and we look at how many platelets you have. These are important for blood clotting, and we look at how big they are. Sometimes we can get very important clues about immune problems by looking at platelets. For example, the Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome is associated with a very low number of platelets and very small platelets. So even from looking at non-lymphocytes and other non-white blood cells, we can get important clues sometimes. But of course, as immunologists, we really care most about the white blood cells, and we want to know how many white blood cells there are. It's usually measured in thousands per cubic millimeter or microliter, and we want to know the differential. And what that means is the proportion of all the different kinds of white blood cells that we find in the circulation. And these are the major types of white blood cells that we distinguish. And those are the neutrophils, which are sometimes called polymorphonuclear cells, or PMNs. And those are important phagocytic cells, which means they ingest or eat germs, bacteria, things of that nature, fungi. And then, of course, the lymphocytes, which are hugely important for adaptive or specific immunity. We're going to talk a lot about them in this session. Monocytes, which are another type of phagocytic cells, very important for inflammation. Eosinophils, which have a big role to play in allergy and other kinds of inflammation and immune dysregulation. And then the basophils, which are the smallest number of white blood cells in the circulation. And there aren't very many circumstances where we worry about them too much, unless you have too many of them, in which case it can be a signal of some kind of leukemia or something. But they usually don't have that much of a role to play when we're looking at immune function in the context of immune deficiency. So this is just a picture of what these kinds of cells look like in the microscope. It's hard to read them from where I am, but the segmented neutrophils, that's the most abundant by far, and then usually the lymphocytes come next, and these are the monocytes, and these are the eosinophils, and I think the basophils are there. So those are the major types of cells in circulation. As I said, nowadays, the technicians don't really look at the blood under the microscope anymore. All of this counting is done automatically by a machine that's programmed to look at specific characteristics of the size and the granules and the content of these cells and other things about their biology to determine how many of each type of cell you have in the circulation. So that's really the first piece of information that we want to know. Do you have enough lymphocytes? Do you have enough neutrophils and so on? And is there anything abnormal there? But now we want to get more specifics about immunology. And, of course, antibody production and immunoglobulins. I imagine most people here have probably had some conversations about this with healthcare providers in their lifetime. And so, as you know, immunoglobulins, the word often used interchangeably with antibodies, these are proteins that are soluble in blood and body fluids that have a very important role in attaching to germs and protecting us from infections with all kinds of things, viruses, bacteria, and so on. There are five major classes of immunoglobulins, IgG, IgA, IgM, IgD, and IgE. We tend to measure all of these routinely for clinical purposes except for IgD. That one doesn't really come up very often, and so it's not really customary for anybody to be looking very closely at that for most purposes. Every once in a while, we might measure IgG subclasses for particular reasons. There are also subclasses of IgA, which we almost never measure, and there really is very little in relation to immune deficiency diagnosis that relates to the IgA subclasses. So we usually measure immunoglobulins by a process which is called nephelometry or turbidimetry, and this is kind of interesting. This is just a diagram of an IgG molecule. This is one molecule. This is a separate one, and it has two parts of this molecule here and here that bind to germs and other things in the circulation, like toxins. And then there's another part of the molecule here that interacts with white blood cells, and that's how the IgG molecule does what it does, which is to work with white blood cells to help fight infection. But the IgG molecule is not only something that we look at as a way of diagnosing immune deficiency, but this is also a workhorse of medicine and biotechnology. Exploiting the structure and the function of the IgG molecule is like an entire biotechnological revolution in medicine and science itself. We use this every day in every area of biological science. It's really, I could talk for days about IgG and nothing else. So how do we measure the concentration of these things in the blood? Well, in fact, you take human IgG and you inject it into another animal, let's say a goat, And then the goat makes its own IgG antibodies that bind to human IgG. And that then becomes a tool that we use in the laboratory to actually measure how much IgG is in a person's circulation. How do we do that? So there's this machine called a nephelometer or a turbidimeter, and sometimes they are working together, and it's got this little chamber called a cuvette, which is basically just like a little cup. So we put in here a solution that has our goat anti-human IgG antibodies, and that's a perfectly clear solution, and you shine a beam of light through it, and it passes right through, and there's a detector on the other side and says, okay, this is a clear solution. So then we add your serum to this tube, and the goat IgG in there starts to react with your IgG, and all of a sudden this solution then becomes cloudy because those things clump together and they make these huge complexes. So now instead of a clear solution, we have a cloudy solution, and less light gets to this detector and it begins to scatter light, so we see more light coming into these other detectors. And when we compare the cloudiness of your blood with the cloudiness that is obtained when we use known concentrations of IgG, we can then calculate how much IgG is in your blood. And we do the same thing for IgA and the same thing for IgM. And this is how you actually measure the concentration of those major classes of immunoglobulin in your bloodstream. IgE happens to exist at very low amounts, thousands of times less than IgG and IgA, and I'll tell you how we measure that in a minute. So we measure your immunoglobulins, and let's say you have low IgG, and maybe you have low IgA and IgM too, so that's sort of a generic word. We call that hypogammaglobulinemia, and that's usually we mean low IgG when we say hypogammaglobulinemia, but many of you know that sometimes you can have low levels of the other ones at two as well. If you have a low level of an IgG subclass, IgG 1, 2, 3, or 4, that might be an IgG subclass deficiency. If you're missing IgA altogether, that could be IgA deficiency. And if you don't have any immunoglobulins at all, that could be X-linked agammaglobulinemia, for example. Okay, so we want to know not only how much of each type of immunoglobulin you have, but we want to know how good your immune system is at making specific antibodies. And very often, we measure everybody's response to all the vaccines that they get as children or adults. And these include things like tetanus vaccines, pneumococcal vaccines, and so on. Those are among the most commonly measured, and there are a variety of ways of doing that. So some of the main techniques are ELISA and RIA. So ELISA stands for enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, and RIA stands for radioimmunoassay, and we usually get a readout in a concentration like micrograms per milliliter or units per milliliter. And when we measure antibodies to proteins, we usually look at your response to a tetanus or diphtheria toxoid. But we can also look at levels of antibodies to other things that people have been immunized or infected with. And then we also often measure antibodies against polysaccharides or sugars, such as the capsular polysaccharides of pneumococcal bacteria, or the sugars that are found on the surface of meningococcus, the bacteria that can cause meningitis. Interpretation of antibody levels sometimes can be a little bit tricky, but in any case, it's a very important part of immune evaluation. So this is how this kind of an assay works. So this is a half of what's called a 96-well plate. And basically, you're looking from the top to the bottom. And each one of these little circles is just a little plastic cup that's sitting on this tiny plastic plate. It's only about the size of my hand. In this diagram, each one of these little things is one well of this plate. So let's say I want to measure how much antibody you make to tetanus toxoid. So I take a solution that has tetanus toxoid in it, and I stick it in this little well. I let it sit there for a while, and a bunch of the tetanus toxoid sticks to the bottom in the plastic. And then I wash the rest of it away. Then I add your blood. And these little yellow things represent your IgG molecules in your bloodstream. So they're all sitting here for a while, and whatever IgG you have in your blood that can bind to the tetanus toxoid, it just sits there, and then when we wash the rest away, the only IgG that's left is your tetanus toxoid binding IgG. Okay, what do we do next? Well, now we add another IgG molecule, and this could be just like that goat anti-human IgG that I talked about before, except this time we add something to it. We stick a little tag on that goat anti-IgG molecule, and it can be a lot of different things. In the case of this assay, it's an enzyme. And so we put that goat antibody in there, and any of your IgG that's stuck on this plate, well, that goat antibody then sticks to your IgG in there, and now we have this enzyme that's trapped there, and now we add another thing, a substrate, which is something that the enzyme works on, and now this changes color through the action of this enzyme. So now we can measure the amount of color change, and that tells us how much of this enzyme is in there, and that tells us how much of your tetanus toxoid antibody is in that well. And so again, we compare that to standard concentrations, and then we know how much tetanus toxoid binding IgG you have in your blood. And we can do this 100 times with 100 different things. All you got to do is start with a different thing at the beginning: tetanus toxoid, diphtheria toxoid, Haemophilus influenza, rubella virus, blah, 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 blah. It's all the same. And so this is an extremely powerful technique, as you can imagine, for measuring the concentrations of antibodies in a solution. Now, I mentioned in this method that this is an enzyme, and that's the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. That's why it's called an ELISA. Well, what if I labeled this antibody with a radioactive molecule? Well, that's a radioimmunoassay, and everything is exactly the same, except instead of a color change, I measure the radioactivity that is in the well, and that's how I know how much antibody is bound. So that's a radioimmunoassay. What if I label it with a fluorescent molecule instead? A fluorescent molecule is something that gives off light of a particular color when you shine a laser at it, just like this one. So if I label it that, then it's a fluorescent immunoassay, and you just use a different kind of machine to read it, but the principle is the same for all of them. We have these different ways that we can label these antibodies that recognize our antibodies stuck to this plate, and that's how we measure the concentration of those things. I'm going to come back to this later because there's another twist on this particular type of method that we're going to come to. Okay, so that's how we measure vaccine antibodies. So how do we look at the white blood cells? What's the most common way we do this? And this is by another incredibly powerful technique called flow cytometry. Now, what does this picture show? Okay, this is a white blood cell. Imagine it's any white blood cell. It happens to be a lymphocyte, but it could be anything. And we have all of these little things glommed on the surface of this cell. Now, these are enlarged artificially for the purposes of an illustration, okay? So you would not be able to see all of these different protein molecules on the surface of a cell. They're too small, even in this diagram. But they're here for representational purposes. So you see there's like, whatever, 25 different kinds of little doohickeys glued all over the surface of this lymphocyte. Well, what are they telling us? They're telling us what kind of a lymphocyte it is. You know that there are T cells, and you know that there are B cells, and you know that there are natural killer cells, and you know that even within those types of lymphocytes, there are subsets. There are helper T cells and cytotoxic T cells, and the list goes on and on. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of different types of T cells and B cells. How do we tell them apart? Well, we've discovered over the decades that helper T cells have certain kinds of doohickey on the cell surface, and B cells have other kinds of doohickey stuck on the cell surface. And if we could figure out some way to label them and see them and visualize them, then we would know what kind of a cell we're dealing with. How do we do that? So people have purified all of these little doohickeys, and what do? They injected them into animals, and they had those animals make antibodies that specifically recognize those little things. So it's the same theme all over again. We have mouse antibodies to white blood cell antigens. Most of them are mice. Some of them are rat. But they're tools. They let us read what's on the surface of the cell. And so the importance of this is you'll often hear phrases, and you'll hear a lot me say this a lot in 5 minutes. CD1, CD2, CD3, CD4, what does that mean? Well, CD is just the system for naming all of these crazy things on the surfaces of our blood cells, and it stands for cluster designation or cluster of differentiation antigen. There are hundreds of these. I don't know how long the list is now. It's probably around 400 or 500 different cell surface molecules that have been defined, and they're just numbered. CD1, CD2, CD3, yada, yada, yada. Sometimes you'll have a CD11A or CD11B or whatever. And all of them refer to distinct molecules that you can find on the surfaces of white blood cells. Okay, so for example, CD3 is a molecule that's on the surface of all T cells. And some T cells have CD4, and we call those helper T cells, and some T cells have CD8, we call those cytotoxic T cells. B cells have CD19, and they have CD20, and we can use either one of those to identify B cells. Natural killer cells are another kind of lymphocyte. They don't have CD3. For instance, B cells don't have CD3 either. CD3 is exclusive to T cells. But natural killer cells, they have one or another or both of these things, CD16 and CD56. So how do we figure out who's got what? We have this machine. It's called a flow cytometer. And this is what the flow cytometer does. We label those antibodies that I mentioned. So I have my mouse anti-CD3 antibody, and I put a fluorescent tag on that antibody, and that fluorescent tag has a specific color. So I'm going to put a red-colored antibody against CD3 in my tube, and that's one. So now I'm going to have a different one. Let's say I want to identify helper T cells, so I'm going to put a yellow CD4 antibody in that solution, and then I can put a green CD8 antibody in that solution, and I can put a blue CD19 antibody in that solution, and you can do up to like 10 or 11 with modern machines, and you can look at all of those things at the same time, because after you put these antibodies and they stick on the surface of the lymphocytes, you then force them to go single file through this tiny, tiny little tube inside the machine where it shines a laser on one cell, and that cell gives off whatever colors of whatever antibodies are stuck on its surface, and the machine reads that. And it does that for every single cell that goes by. And that's how you see where are the T cells, where are the B cells, and how many are there of each one. And this is what the readout of that kind of an analysis looks like. So this is a graph, and this is the x-axis, and this is the y-axis. So in this type of a graph, this represents brightness. When you're close to zero, you're dim. When you're far away from zero, you're bright. So we're not going to worry about the y-axis of this one, but on this axis here is the brightness for CD3. So we have, in this person's blood, we have two populations of cells. We have some cells that are bright for CD3, and those are the T cells, because that's a T cell marker. And we have another group of cells that are dim for CD3, because they don't express it, and that's everything that's not a T cell. So we can focus now on just the cells that have CD3, and now we can look here at CD8, and here at CD4. And so the cells that are bright for CD8, these are our cytotoxic T cells here, and the cells that are bright for CD4 are over here, and those are our helper T cells. And then we can also look at the non-T cells. These are the ones that don't express CD3. And then we can look at the CD19 marker here. So all of these cells that are bright for CD19, those are B cells. And all of these cells that are bright for either CD16 or CD56, those are the natural killer cells. So this is Just one very quick way of looking at all of the major lymphocyte populations in the blood at the same time. And we can do this using all kinds of different combinations of markers. So nowadays, there are dozens and dozens of white blood cell surface markers that we use to look at all of the different subtypes of lymphocytes that you have in your circulation. And that's how we often get very important clues about where a problem might be with the immune system function and where we want to focus further testing. The other part of this printout, of course, is just the numbers. So we get the percentage of all of the lymphocytes. So the CD3 cells in this patient are about 32% of all of the cells, all of the lymphocytes, and it corresponds to just under 1,000 cells per cubic millimeter. And we have that information for all of the different subsets. So this blood specimen happened to come from an infant, I think two, maybe 3 months old. And as it happens, this is a terribly low number of T cells for a two-month-old or a three-month-old. And so this is telling us that there's something going on with the T cells of this child. I don't know what it might be just from looking at this, but this is a warning that this baby has some kind of T cell problem, and we have to work then further to figure out what it is. Okay, so having introduced the concept of the flow cytometer, I just want to go back to the solid phase assay thing. So remember that in this diagram, this represents a well in the 96-well plate. Well, imagine that this isn't the bottom of a plastic well, but this is actually the surface of a microscopic plastic bead that's so small you can't even see it. In fact, it's the size of a white blood cell. You can do all of this on the surface of this microscopic plastic bead, and having done that, you can then put your microscopic plastic beads through the flow cytometer, and you can measure things that are stuck on the surface of those beads in exactly the same way that I told you you look at the things that are stuck on the surfaces of white blood cells. So this is another way that we can measure things like concentrations of antibodies. This is how you measure IgE, for example, in your circulation. And when you do blood tests to measure IgE to things in food allergies that you might have or environmental allergies that you might have, you use microscopic beads and you coat them with IgE. Excuse me, you coat them with an antigen, like milk proteins, for example. Then you put them in your blood, and any antibodies, IgE antibodies that you have, can stick there. And then you put your antibody that recognizes human IgE with a label on it, in this case a fluorescent label, and then you put it through the flow cytometer, and you can measure the brightness, and that tells you how much of the allergen-specific IgE is stuck on the cell. And that's, in fact, how we also measure antibodies to pneumococcal capsular sugars, too. So that's how we look at the numbers of the different kinds of white blood cells. So how do we look at T cell function? You know, when we measure your vaccine responses, then one way that's looking at B cell function, because B cells are the cells that make antibodies. So if you make good antibodies against vaccines and you have normal immunoglobulin levels, then we know your B cells are working pretty okay. So how do we look at T cell function in the test tube? Well, we do something called in vitro, which just means in the test tube, lymphocyte stimulation with mitogens and antigens. So how does that work? So we take a culture dish, and we purify your white blood cells, and we throw them in that culture dish. And then we put in some chemical that makes your T cells get really excited and want to divide and multiply. And so these are called mitogens because they induce mitosis, which is cell division. So after we put in the mitogen, your T cells go crazy, and they start making more of themselves. So when cells divide, they have to copy their DNA. So they're synthesizing a lot of DNA while they're dividing. And so we add in a DNA precursor that is radioactive. and it has tritium on it. So we call it tritiated thymidine. And thymidine is a precursor of one of the building blocks of DNA. So while these cells are dividing in the culture, they're taking up this radioactive thymidine from the medium in the culture, and these cells are becoming radioactive. So after they've been sitting in there for a couple of days, we just run this solution over a paper filter disc. All of the cells get stuck on the filter paper and all of the medium from the culture goes away. And we just take this piece of filter paper and we put it in a machine that counts the radioactivity. And that's how you know how much the cells divided, because the amount of radioactivity that's in the cells that get stuck on the paper is directly proportional to the amount of cell division that happened. So if you put in the mitogens and the cells don't do anything, they don't take up any radioactivity, and you count zero, and that's no response. And that means that those T cells are just not working. On the other hand, if we put in our mitogen and the T cells go crazy, they divide a lot, we count a lot of radioactivity on the filter paper, and that means, great, the T cells are fine, they responded properly to the stimulus that you put in the culture, and everything is okay. So mitogens are very powerful stimuli for T cells. So if your T cells don't respond properly to a mitogen, your T cells are in bad shape, and that is an indication of a relatively serious T cell functional problem. Because mitogens are such powerful stimuli, even if your T cells are a little bit weak, they might be able to respond pretty well anyway. So we sometimes will use specific antigens, such as tetanus or diphtheria toxoid, or maybe antigens from yeast like candida, and we can do the exact same thing. We'll put the cells in culture, not with a mitogen, but with tetanus toxoid. And so if you've been immunized with tetanus toxoid, you should have a few T cells in here that will recognize that and will begin to respond by going into cell division. And it's the exact same principle. If you have T cells that appropriately recognize and respond to tetanus toxoid, they start to divide, they incorporate radioactivity, and you can count that and you can see. So again, if your T cells respond properly to antigens like tetanus toxoid or candida yeast in the culture, then they're working fine and you've got no problems. If they don't, then of course there could be an issue there that could be important for understanding your immunological big picture, and we would want to investigate further. Is everybody doing okay? Am I making my points? Okay, good. I see a lot of nodding heads. Hopefully it's not people falling asleep. Okay, so we've done B cell function, right? Vaccine antibodies. We've done a little bit about T cell function. So what about natural killer cells? Well, sometimes they're very important for protecting us from certain kinds of infections, and we want to know how they work too. And this is a very classic assay. This was developed decades ago, and it's still the gold standard for measuring natural killer cell function, and it's called the chromium release assay. And how this works is there's a particular kind of target cell, and everybody uses the same target cell. It's a leukemia cell line. I don't know who it came from decades ago, but somebody got sick and had their leukemia cells expanded and stored in labs all around the world, and they're still being propagated and probably are larger in mass than that person ever was as a human being. I don't know if everybody has read or knows about Henrietta Lacks, who is the woman who gave rise to what are called HeLa cells, which have also been used a lot in science throughout the years. So this is a similar kind of situation. So in any case, we have these target cells. They're called K562 cells, and we just put them in a test tube with a bunch of radioactive chromium, and the chromium molecules get absorbed into those cells, and then when we collect those cells, now they're radioactive. So we put them in a dish, and we take the white blood cells from a patient, we call these effector cells, and we throw them in a dish with these target cells. So it just so happens that normal human natural killer cells don't like these target cells and they want to kill them. And so as the natural killer cells do their thing, these target cells are destroyed and they release their chromium into the culture medium. So now we just measure the amount of radioactivity in the culture medium and we know how many of those target cells were killed by the natural killer cells. And so we do this at what are different effector to target ratios. So 50 to 1, 25 to 1, 12 to 1, 6 to 1. And then we look at the percentage of the target cells that were killed, and this is normal. So we see in this case that at every concentration, the natural killer cells really were not doing their job properly, because if they were normal, they would be higher than the numbers in this column. There's a particular calculation that's done to derive what are called lytic units so that it's a standard measure. And this patient had 0.9 lytic units, which is well below normal. So this is an example of a patient who has some kind of defect of natural killer cell function. We don't know what the reason for that defect is. All we know is that this person's natural killer cells are not working properly in the test tube. So before we leave lymphocytes, I wanted to talk briefly about newborn screening for a severe combined immunodeficiency. Even though this is a little bit different from testing individual patients for immune deficiency, it is an extremely important recent development, I think, in medicine in this country, especially as it relates to people with immune deficiency. So I wanted to take a few minutes just to talk about it. So the basis for the newborn screening for SCID has to do with something called a T-cell receptor excision circle, or TREC. And basically, this is a piece of DNA that is formed inside the nucleus of T-cells when they develop in the thymus during gestation and after gestation as well. So when you were developing in the womb and even for years later, your thymus was churning out T-cells, and inside these T cells are these things, the TRECs, the T cell receptor excision circles. So cells are dividing in the thymus and boom, they make a TREC. They continue to divide, but the TREC doesn't disappear. So even when cells leave the thymus and now they're in the peripheral blood and the circulation and other tissues of your body, a certain proportion of them have TRECs. As the cells expand in your body, the TRECs remain, but there are very few of them. So when the concentration of TRECs is very high, it means that your thymus is putting out lots and lots and lots of new cells. If the concentration of TRECs in the circulation is low, it means that your thymus isn't doing very much, and all you have are T cells that have been around for a long time. And so, as you can imagine, when babies are just born, their thymuses are just churning out lots and lots of T cells, and so the amount of TRECs in a baby's circulation are very high. As you get older and older and older, that number goes way, 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 way down, and it's a very steady progression over a person's lifetime. So you can actually, as you, all of you who had a child know, and within the first 2 days of life, some mean nurse sticks a big needle in the kid's heel and collects all of these blood spots on a piece of filter paper, and that gets sent off to the newborn screening lab. Well, you can take a little piece of one of those dried blood spots, and you can actually get the DNA out of it, and there are techniques to measure the amount of TRECs that are present in that little piece of filter paper, and that's how we do the newborn screen. If you have a good number of TRECs on your dried blood spot, that means your thymus is working great and you're making lots of T cells. If the number of TRECs in your dried blood spot is really low, there's something wrong. And that's how we identify the population of kids who may have a serious thymus problem or severe combined immune deficiency, and we then go on to study them by doing something like the flow cytometry that I showed you a few minutes ago, which was exactly what happened. That was actually a specimen from a child who had an abnormally low TREC result, and we brought her in and we did the phenotypic analysis of her white blood cells in her circulation, and we saw that her total number of T cells was too low. So now we have to continue to work on that child to figure out where the problem is in her T cells. All right. So, as you all know, lymphocytes are not the only cells that are important for immune function. We also have phagocytic cells like neutrophils and so on, and there are certain forms of immune deficiency that involve only those types of cells. One of the biggest examples, of course, being chronic granulomatous disease, which is almost exclusively a problem related to neutrophil function. So we always go back to the blood count when we're looking at these patients, because often the count, just the total number of neutrophils, is an important clue. Some children are born with very few or no neutrophils, and that's called neutropenia, and there's a whole slew of syndromes that are related to neutropenia. Some people have very high numbers of white blood cells all the time, and that can be related to a particular category of disease called leukocyte adhesion deficiency. So sometimes you can get an important clue just by looking at the number of the white blood cells in the CBC. In addition to that, we have tests of the actual function of the cells themselves. So, I remember what I wanted to say. So sometimes even looking at the cells under the microscope, so I don't know if you remember from the first pictures that I showed, a lot of those white blood cells have little granules inside them, and those all have very specific structure and function, and sometimes even just by looking at those white blood cells under the microscope, you can see abnormalities that can help you focus on particular areas for diagnosis. But going back to oxidative function, so this is the root of what the issue is in chronic granulomatous disease, which is probably the most commonly diagnosed form of neutrophil dysfunction that exists. So there's an old-fashioned test called the nitroblue tetrazoleum test, or NBT for short, which was done for decades. But it's not technically very easy. It's very labor-intensive and time-consuming and not very accurate. So it's been replaced by something called the DHR test. So the doctor says they want to send the NBT test on your child. You say, no, doctor, that test is obsolete. You want to send the DHR test and see what happens. So how does the DHR test work? So, again, it involves flow cytometry. So DHR is an abbreviation for this long word, dihydrorhodamine, which is just a fluorescent dye. And so we take your white blood cells, and we incubate them with the dihydrorhodamine, and we give them some other chemicals to activate them. And so the activated cells basically change the color of the dihydrorhodamine dye. So when you put them through your flow cytometer, you can actually measure how much brightness is coming from the dihydrorhodamine. And this is a very simple assay. It's just one color. And so this is a graph that is just showing you brightness on this scale. This is dim, this is bright, and this is just the number of cells that have each level of brightness. So these are unstimulated cells, and you can see that the DHR dye is very dim. This is a healthy person, and these are two children who are being tested. So after we activate the cells of the healthy person, they all become very bright. The brightness shifts all the way over to this side, but we can see that these two children, the brightness doesn't shift nearly as much. This is very much impaired in comparison to that. So both of these children, this is a male and female twin, so clearly not identical, they must have some form of autosomal recessive chronic granulomatous disease, and that's how we use the DHR test to make this type of a diagnosis. Okay, complement. Some of you may have heard about complement. Complement is a very complex system of proteins in the blood that work with antibodies. I'm getting close to the end. You know what? I'm going to skip complement because I want to talk a little bit about sequencing. Sequencing is all the rage nowadays. A lot of people want genetic testing. And people talk a lot about whole exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing and how this is sort of the revolution of medicine. And so I just wanted to take a minute to talk about sequencing. So So you remember, what is a sequence? What do people mean when they say sequence? What is the significance? So you remember that human, everybody's, in fact, everybody's DNA, not just humans, is composed of four bases, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, A, C, G, T. And any DNA sequence has those four letters and no others. And the human genome has 3 billion of these letters. 3 billion base pairs, and that constitutes a human genome. So when you're talking about whole genome sequencing, you're talking about reading the sequence of 3 billion units. All right? So the exome is the part of the genome that is expressed. So as it turns out, most of the DNA in our body isn't there to code for proteins that make up our bodies. It's there for other purposes that we don't completely understand that has something to do with regulating how genes are expressed. So the actual part of our DNA that codes for the stuff that makes us up, it's only between 1 and 2% of the total. So the exome, or the expressed genome, is about 60 million base pairs. So it's much easier to sequence the exome than it is to sequence the whole genome. However, you give up a certain ability to find problems when you only look at a small percentage. It turns out that about 85% of identifiable diseases in this way can be found by doing exome sequencing. To get the other 15%, you have to sequence the entire genome. So there's a trade-off of higher cost to sequence the genome and much higher technical complexity to sequence the genome, but you gain some sensitivity. If you just sequence the smaller part, the exome, the expressed genome, you find 85% of diseases only, but it costs a little bit less. So just really quickly, how does that work? So this is your genome right here. And it's a double strand, and so we make it single-stranded. And then we have a reaction that lets us read this sequence. How does that work? So we have enzymes that can add bases or nucleotides at each of these positions to make a chain here. And so we have one reaction that will randomly stop, but only at a C. And then we have a separate reaction that will randomly stop, but only at G's, and then a separate one that randomly stops, but only at A's, and then a fourth one that randomly stops, but only at T's. So in this reaction, you have lots of pieces. They're all different lengths, but the end of every piece is a C. And every time it reaches the end and it puts in one of those ending C's, it has a fluorescent tag. So it has a color. So all of the pieces that end at a C will be blue. And the same thing, all of the pieces that end at a G will be yellow. All the pieces that end at A will be red. And all the pieces that end at T will be green. And so they're all different lengths. So you can now sort them according to size. And then you just read, a machine reads the sequence of colors. And that's how you know the sequence, because it's yellow, green, blue, red, whatever, and you just read the sequence that way by a machine. So this is your whole genome right here. You just chop it up into little pieces. You read the sequence by those chemical reactions of each of those little pieces. Because it's chopped up randomly, there are lots of overlapping pieces, so you use a computer to figure out where the ends overlap, and then it just assembles the whole thing into one big long sequence. And that's how you sequence the genome. And then you compare the sequence of your genome to this huge database of sequences of thousands of people who've had their genome sequenced, and that's where you figure out, oh, okay, here's a change, there's a change, and there's a change. Any individual who goes through this process will have tens or hundreds, if not even a few thousand, variants detected by the process. And then the real challenge is to figure out which one of those have meaning for that person's disease. And so often it's very helpful to study parents and siblings who are not ill, because when they have the same variants as the patient, then the likelihood that those variants are important for that patient's disease are quite small. You want those variants that are particular just to the patient, and then you'll have some sense that this may be disease-causing or disease-associated. So I was hoping to have a little bit more time for questions, but I think I used it all up. I hope that was interesting. Thank you.